you.
Thanks for making it sound like there's more people here. Can I put this stuff, like, somewhere? Cool. Thanks, man. Hi, my name is Mike Bach. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Stephen and Blair for calling me last night and asking me to fill in for Tommy. I was kind of looking forward to hearing his talk and not really looking forward to speaking myself. But, you know, it's always an honor to do something like this. And, you know, every time I talk, I get this, I remember this, the airplane movies. And the main character is chasing this, his old flame around, and he ends up on a plane because he's a stewardess, and he sits next to somebody and starts telling a story, and almost immediately they become nauseous. And he's not even halfway through his story, and they can't take it anymore. So they, you know, light themselves on fire or perforate their abdomen with a knife or something like that. So I'm hoping I don't have that effect on you guys tonight. And, you know, I was listening to a speaker tape the other day, and I heard an observation made about alcoholics by this guy. And he's one of my favorite speakers, Father Terry from L.A., and that I don't hear really anybody else make all that often. You know, is that alcoholics are, you know, we're really boring, you know. I mean, that we have, you know, these stories that we used to illustrate, you know, how bad our lives got to give, you know, depth and context to what we do here, right, to make it seem a bit more meaningful, as if we have to do that. But, I mean, really, you know, and when he said, you know, we feel we become interesting and we actually get really, really boring. And, you know, I always kind of think about, you know, in between the arrests and the car wrecks and the trips to the hospital and jail and all that kind of stuff, really, I mean, I was just an extraordinarily boring pain in the ass. You know, I was the kind of guy who was sitting at the bar and start talking to somebody and, you know, they were like, yeah, I'm going to sit over here now. You know, I mean, you know, and because we're boring, you know, I mean, and I couldn't believe, you know, that people wouldn't want to hear what I'd have to say. And, you know, but I mean, it's, and he talks about, he's talking about how, you know, with all the heavy breathing, once we get really loaded and, you know, saying things over and over and over again, you know, not realizing that we're doing that and, you know, defining words incorrectly and all that kind of stuff. And I could relate to it like that. But anyway, my sobriety date is June 3rd of 2003, so what that means to me is I haven't had a drink or anything else to tune my head since that day, and it is strictly through AA and the God that I found here that I have that time. I am sponsored. I have the privilege of sponsoring two guys right now. The grateful one is here tonight. And, and I have a home group, too. That's the Simple Solution Group in St. Pete, Florida, and we meet on Mondays and Wednesdays at 8 o'clock. Some of you have been there. If you're ever in the area on those nights, we'd love to have you. So, I would not be here if I didn't drink, you know, and I drank quite a bit. And without going a lot into the details about my upbringing, I, you know, I came up in a very nice home with very nice and loving parents and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, I think my earliest memory really basically can be simmered down to this. I never liked who I was. I never thought, and no one put that on me, but I didn't like who I was. Everything I did, I felt didn't measure up. I got jealous of other people very easily because I thought, and I felt as if they had something in their makeup that made life easier for them. And that things that seemed easy to other people, social interaction, sports, just being, academics, all that kind of stuff, just being in the world, being a human being, seemed so much easier for other people. And I lived with that as, you know, from as far back as I can remember. And when I first got drunk, and that plagued me. I mean, that was something that guided me every day. There was not a day where I didn't have a thought that, you know, I'm not good enough. I hate who I am. I can't stand this. You know, why can't I be like everybody else? You know, and it wasn't like that. It's not that I really wanted to fit in. I just wanted that thing that made everything easier, and everything seemed so hard. And it's like I said, I didn't come up in a bad home. I didn't really have any external reason to point to and say, well, this is why it's hard. I wanted for nothing when I was growing up as a kid. I went to great schools. My parents loved and cared for me very much. They provided me with everything I could possibly, you know, need, and some of the things I even wanted. But I always had that feeling that I was missing something. And when I got drunk for the first time, that feeling went away completely. And not only did I not hate myself anymore, but I thought I was pretty awesome, you know. And, you know, and it seemed to me that other people thought I was pretty awesome too. You know, alcohol provided me with a feeling that was so powerful that it trumped reality, really, you know. And I love it when, you know, you hear drunks get up here and they talk about their first drunk, or, you know, when they got drunk, it made them bigger and stronger and faster and better looking and better conversationalists and expert in many subjects and all this kind of stuff. And it really didn't make you that way. It made you feel that way. You were still a jackass, but I mean, you felt as if you were all the things that you wanted to be. And that's essentially what booze did for me. And up to the point where I got drunk for the first time, alcohol held no appeal for me whatsoever. And one of the reasons for that was I didn't understand what the big deal was, you know. I remember when I was growing up, I mean, my parents would give me sips off their beers and that kind of stuff like that, and I didn't like the taste or anything like that. And also, there was a big, scandal's too big of a word, but there was a big problem in the class 2 years ahead of me where a bunch of the kids got caught drinking and they lost their scholarships to schools and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, everything, you know, and I had friends who were drinking and drugging and doing all that kind of stuff, but I mean, I didn't see the point. It wasn't worth it to me. I wanted to do well in school. I wanted to do well in the sports I was in. I was being considered, like Morgan, I was a cross-country runner. And so I was being considered for scholarships, and I didn't want to mess that up. And it didn't seem like, you know, booze was worth it, you know. So I had no problem staying away from it. People said, hey, we're going over here. I'm like, no, I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go to my job or do something else. And I didn't feel like I was missing out on anything. Well, one time I went to this party to hit on this girl, and that didn't work out. And a couple of the upperclassmen who were at that party knew that I was not a drinker, and they decided to turn me into one that night, and they jammed a couple beer bongs down my throat. And, you know, I hated it at first, and then when they finally let me up after doing 3 or 4 of these things, I was overcome with this feeling that we all get. And like I said, I'm pretty awesome. I'm going to go back in there and show everybody how awesome I am. And it was just everything. I don't even know how to describe it to this very day. I mean, I've heard speakers take 20 minutes to do this, and I don't want to do that. I mean, it was the answer to all my problems. There was nothing wrong when I was drinking. There was nothing wrong. Whereas when I wasn't, there was nothing right, you know. And that's the best way and most simple way I can describe it. So the first beers were forced down my throat, and now, but by the time I got back, the next, you know, 7, 8, 9, or whatever they may have been, you know, I drank. And what happened after that time, besides getting in a little bit of trouble with my parents and getting grounded for a while and that kind of stuff, is that the priorities in my life had changed. It's no longer about, you know, getting good grades and showing up for cross-country practice and doing my morning training and all that kind of stuff. It's about, when can I do this next? It was seemed almost instantly that my friends and associates had changed. Now it wasn't, hey, you want to go for a run this morning or anything like that? It's like, you know, where is the party at this weekend? Who's holding? Who's got a fake ID? Where are the liquor stores that serve minors? There were a lot of those back in my time. And, you know, that became the priority. Everything else was a very distant second, if it was even on the map. And I didn't drink every day for a very long time after that, you know, about 6 years, I guess, or something like that. But it became the most important thing in my life that day. And everything I did after that, you know, it seemed as if, and it's probably very true, that everything I did was so I could drink. You know, that it wasn't to achieve anything or accomplish anything. It's like, okay, I'll go to college because, you know, and I'll never forget, I went on a college trip with my old man, and my grand sponsor has a similar story because we went to very similar schools, my first grand sponsor, and, you know, when we pulled up to the school where I ended up going, you know, I mean, there were guys passed out in the lawn, and there were the white beer cups all over the place and all that kind of stuff, and I'm like, I want to go here, you know, and that's where I went, and I did do some athletics there, but and I managed to keep it pretty clean during when I was in training and that kind of stuff, but it was always about when I could drink next, you know, and when I was a senior, I had a really bad injury to my knee, and my running career was pretty much over with. It was really disgusting. I think I've told some people this. I mean, it happened on my home campus, and there was a girl who was on the trail watching the race, and when she saw it happen, she threw up on me, and because it was that gross, and it was extraordinarily painful. And I'll tell you, emotionally, most of the other guys on my team, it would have devastated them. I mean, it would have devastated them. You know, they wouldn't have been able to. I mean, you know, it was, like I said, it was career-ending. It was really nasty. And they would, I mean, this would have been one of the worst days of their lives. And I was like, so now I don't have to do this crap anymore. You know, and I was on crutches and a big cast for a long time. So, I got sympathy beers at all the parties and all that kind of stuff. And, I mean, it was great. I got waited on all the time because I was on crutches. I had girls feed me beers because I had to hold myself up on a crutch. I mean, just, like, basically blew up my knee, and I'm like, this is awesome, you know. And, but anyway. And somehow, I mean, I know a lot of alcoholics don't have this experience, but I managed to graduate from college. But what I will tell you, in 4 years, with a pretty decent GPA, but what I will tell you is when I made amends to my folks much later on, they told me that the day they saw me graduate from college was one of the worst days in their lives because of the condition I was in. And I could barely get up on the stage, and I did a host of things, you know, by the time that they had come into town. I was kind of trying to get this graduation thing done pretty quickly because I was convinced that the Geneva, New York police were looking for me. I knew that wasn't paranoia. I mean, they were looking for me, and I, you know, and they just said, you know, they were just so mortified by what they had seen me become. I didn't go home much because I went far away to school, and, you know, so I graduated, but it was not a proud day for my parents, and, you know, obviously it wasn't a very proud day for me looking back on it. So I went away to Washington D.C. because I somehow finagled a job offer down there, and I went through a bunch of really good opportunities. You know, that's probably one thing that defines my early drinking the most is that I squandered a lot of opportunities. And I think most of us get opportunities. at each stop I did, thanks, man. At each stop I did, I would. At each stop I did, I mean, the bartenders would set me up and buy me lunch and buy me beers and all that kind of stuff. Plus, I didn't with. I mean, the bartenders in the city, so I mean. You know, I'd throw a $20 tip down, and I'd get served $50 worth of booze, you know, wherever I went. And so for me, at that time, that was awesome. But what I didn't realize I was doing was just destroying my life piece by piece by piece. And, you know, I had, if you could call it that, a couple relationships during that time, and all that I took away from those were regrets. And if you want... I think sometimes newcomers wonder about why we caution against dating when you're new, besides the fact that it's usually, you know, just a suicide pact. But, I mean, you know, but it's because, at least in my experience when I look at it, and, you know, my sponsor gave me that direction when I was new to just, you know, stay away from women. And I'm doing them a favor as much as I'm doing you a favor by telling you to do that. But... if you wanted a really good snapshot of my drinking at that time, and my alcoholism, just look at how I treated the women in my life. You know, just horrible. I, you know, lied, cheated all the time. I was verbally and sometimes physically abusive, and you know, and I had done things to those women who I would tell that I loved. I tell them I love them that. You know, I couldn't imagine myself doing. And that's one of the things, I think, you know, another defining thing of my alcoholism is that as time went on, I started doing things that if you had asked me a year before, would you do this? I would say, absolutely not. I'm not that low. I'm not the scumbag you think I am. You know, I get all indignant and stuff. And then, like a year later, I'd find myself doing those things. And I hear that in a lot in alcoholic stories. We manage to lower our standards, our morals, our values, our expectations, because we're powerless over alcohol, and that's the only choice we have. You know, and if we want to continue drinking, we have to do that. And I found myself, you know, in my mid to late 20s, I didn't go to clubs. I didn't go to bars with people my age. The places I went to drink were the kind of places that opened at like 6 a.m. in the morning. And had a bunch of old guys sitting there who were drinking away their pensions and social security checks and disability and all that kind of stuff. There was not anybody within like 30 years of my age at those places. And that's where I drank. And eventually I was like, why bother? And I got involved in bookmaking and drug dealing and all this kind of stuff. And I got myself in a lot of trouble. And, you know, as I stand here today, there's barely a day that goes by where I don't think about how lucky I was to live through that. You know, I hear a story in AA about somebody, you know, I mean, and I knew a lot of guys in that, you know, who were doing the same things I was doing who aren't here to talk about it today. You know, they didn't even make it to AA. And I don't know why I did and they didn't. And I have trouble personally saying that it's God's grace that got me through that. I don't believe that. It's hard for me to believe that God granted that favor to me, but not to some of these people who were no worse than I was. And, you know, but I was, no question, very lucky to live through it. I'm lucky I didn't get killed. I'm lucky I didn't overdose. I'm lucky I didn't die of alcohol poisoning, car wrecks, and all that kind of stuff. You know, I'm just really lucky. But every time I would survive a scrape like that, or I would wake up in the hospital, as time went on and I got older, I was not so pleased with that result of surviving. You know, it became undeniable that my life was just a waste. You know, I couldn't look myself in the mirror. I began to really, really hate myself a lot. And, and by the time I'm in my early 30s, I got sober when I was 32, so I guess, I don't know, 31 or so, I started making resolutions to myself that I was going to stop drinking. You know, I had wanted to stop drinking long before I actually came to AA. And I had gone to AA meetings before, but I mean, you know, I, in hindsight, can find out how insensitive this is. But there used to be a AA meeting downtown, and I would pull up in my beer truck to an AA meeting and, like, go downstairs in my Budweiser uniform, you know, with all these people shaking, trying to, you know, make it one day without a drink. And I'm like, you know, I'm here to get sober, you know. And, well, you might want to change your job. And when they said that, I was gone. You know, there was no willingness at that time. But I, you know, maybe you should go to rehab or something. No, I'm not going to do that. I got thrown out of last rehab. They can't help me and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, what got me to AA was not like I had this, you know, this tremendous moment of clarity and, you know, the heavens opened and the light shined on me and I decided today is the day I'm going to change my life or anything like that. It was like by the time I got to AA, I had nowhere else to go. I was living with my folks. I was 32 years old and I was living with my folks and I had just survived, but I had just gone through chemotherapy for cancer that I got as a result of my drinking, that my throat got all tore up and some of those ulcers metastasized into cancer. And I had ulcers, my liver was distended, I was like 50 pounds underweight, I was just horrible shape. I mean, and, you know, people said my skin began to yellow and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I was not doing well. And then on top of it, everybody was sick of me, you know. People, I mean, my parents were like right there. You know, I mean, and I was living with them and, you know, drinking all their booze, you know, and taking their car and getting drunk and drunk driving in their cars because I lost my car on some bender and all this kind of stuff. And I just kept on doing what I was doing. And I had gone to them saying, well, I want to turn my life around. And the thing is, I didn't really want to do anything like that, you know. But it became undeniable to me that, you know, I had to do something. I found myself making serious, heartfelt commitments to not drink, and then within hours, maybe days, if I was lucky, drinking anyway, and not drinking so much more moderately, although I would try to do that, and, you know, and the thing was, I mean, I had a lot of consequences when I was drinking, you know, a lot of, like I mentioned before, jails, car wrecks, stays in hospitals, blah, blah, blah. A lot of things that, you know, I mean, we're you know, talking rescue 911 stuff here. That never gave me a moment's pause about my drinking. The sick thing about it was, for me, that in a way, when I survived something like that, when earlier on, I thought of it as validation for my lifestyle. Well, if God didn't want me doing this, he would have killed me. You know, and that's nuts. That's just absolutely nuts, but that's kind of how I believed. I mean, that this is the life I was born for. You know, lesser people don't survive this kind of thing. So, I mean, just nuts. And so anyway, I go to AA because, you know, no one wanted me anywhere else. And I don't blame them. I'm not, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want me around either, you know, and so I call the AA Politburo in Milwaukee, and I say, yeah, I'm a drunk. I guess I have to go to one of those meetings. And I got some old-timer on the phone, and he's like, you guess? You know what I mean? And so he sent me to this place that was around the corner from where my parents lived. And I went there, and I'll tell you, I did not have the experience that I sometimes hear in AA, not all the time. I mean, a lot of people have a similar experience to me. I did not have the experience where I walked in AA and somebody told my story and I felt at home or anything like that. I was angry and resentful that my life had turned out this way. And probably what made me that way the most was I could not anymore blame anybody for it. I did that all my life, but there was no one left to point to except me. And that's what, that made me angrier. That didn't give me any clarity or anything like that, or, you know, it just... So I just got angry at everybody, and, you know, people talk about, you know, is it a solution-oriented meeting and all this kind of stuff, and that, no, it wasn't. I mean, I, you know, that's my honest assessment of it. Somebody may think differently, but, I mean, it was one where it was a club, and it was beautiful. It had leather couches, I mean, in good condition, I mean, and everybody, there was really nice cars in the parking lot and all that kind of stuff, and And alcoholics are predisposed to kind of differentiate themselves from everybody else and say, my case is different, and you don't understand, and all that crap we hear from the podium. And I was no different. You know, I went in there, and I'm not like these people. And then, you know, and people talked in a language there that I found far too delicate to describe what I felt, what I was thinking and feeling at that time. And they put value on stuff that I did not care about, like serenity and, you know, contentment and God and spirituality and all that kind of stuff, which I didn't see how it tied to my problem. And, you know, and, you know, I guess it was a typical meeting. You had a bunch of people who were kind of, you know, maybe half measuring it through, and then you had one person who had been sober for a very long time and was really nice and spiritual and would say hi and talk in a soft voice, and you had somebody who was totally, looking back on it, I mean, it's like totally full of crap. And then you'd always have like the big book thumper, you know, would say, you know, my name's Tony T and that's not in the book, you know. And so, I mean, and I'm sitting here, you know, new, and this is kind of my first experience, hearing people talk like this, and then the big book thumper screaming, and the other people saying, no, everybody calm down, I've got 25 years, everybody listen, you know, and I'm just sitting here like, this has got to be the, I mean, and also, this is, I was unmoved, and, you know, and the worst part about it was in Milwaukee, the way most of the meetings run up there is somebody gives a lead, then you break up into small groups and you discuss it, and then you say the Lord's Prayer, and then everybody hugs one another. And to this day, I mean, you know, and it's not just the people you know. I mean, it's everybody. So, you know, you get, you know, fat, stinky, drunk guy, and then, you know, the woman who probably, I guess, is a little lonely, and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I am sitting here, and I just want to blow my brains out. I mean, the worst position for an alcoholic to be in when they have untreated alcoholism is not drinking. You know, and it took me a long time to really realize that. But I look at my first couple, you know, my first few days of sobriety. That was like the worst time in my life. And nothing was happening. I wasn't getting shot at. I wasn't in the hospital. I had some DTs, but not really, you know, nothing that bad. But just each and every moment seemed to last like an hour. And I go to another meeting, and I just hear things that, oh, God, the gift of desperation and the value of surrender and all this kind of stuff. And it wasn't sinking in. And then sometimes I go to the meetings, and, you know, I never really had the feeling that AA was a cult, and I had been to AA meetings before, but there was one I went to on my third day. You know, after the Lord's Prayer, I'm looking for him to pass out the Kool-Aid. I'm just like, you know, that's a bit of an old reference, isn't it? Jim Jones, back in the day, passed out the Kool-Aid to his cult. They all did a mass suicide. Okay. That's kind of like, I mean, because I kind of had that belief about that. You know, I mean, I was like, God, what the hell is going on here? Where are the drunks? You know, where are the people like me? And I bounced around all these meetings. And the fact of the matter is, in that state of mind, I would not have found somebody like me because I was not disposed to doing that. I was disposed to basically, I mean, the first thing an alcoholic does when they get in here and they're unsponsored is try to get out. Okay, I'm here. How can I get out of here as fast as possible? And that's, you know, and I don't know if I would have done that or not, you know, I don't know what would happen, and, you know, I can't stand it and say, well, if this didn't happen, I wouldn't, you know, I know for sure I wouldn't have been here. And no, you don't. You don't know what would happen. All I know is what did happen, and what did happen is, on the fourth day, guy came up to me after the meeting, he shook me, and he stuck his hand out when I was about to, okay, huggy time, you know, and he stuck his hand out and shook my hand, and he said, let's talk. And only by virtue of the fact that he wanted to shake my hand rather than hug me, I said, okay. And he took me out in the parking lot, and we talked for 2 hours. And, you know, he told me a story, and I liked hearing that because for the first time I identified with another alcoholic, you know. And then, that was nice. And then he started telling me about alcoholism, and he started telling me about me. And it seemed this guy, his name is, still is Heath Harris, and he's in Richmond, Virginia, but he sponsored me for my first 3.5 years, and what he did was he pointed out to me everything about alcoholism that I never wanted to know. And he did it in a way that made it personal. And I hated hearing it, but my response to it told me two things. One is that this is what's really going on with me, and two, this guy knows what he's talking about. You know, there's that line in the book, and I'm not a thumper by any stretch of the imagination, but there's a line in the book that I think of all the time when I think of my sponsor, and it's that his whole department shouts at the new man that he has a real answer. And that's exactly how he was all about AA. He was my age, and at that time, you know, he was 32, and he was, like, coming up on 9 years. And I was very impressed with that. You know, I just didn't think that people my age had that kind of time. But more importantly, he read me like a cheap book. I mean, I hated him for it, but I was also very impressed with it, you know. And he said, meet me at this meeting tomorrow. And so I met him at the meeting tomorrow, and he basically said, I'm going to sponsor you because you're screwing around in AA, and if you screw around in AA, you die. And I'd been in AA all 4 days, and he's saying I was screwing around in AA. And I'm like, well, what does the sponsor do? And he says, he tells, you know, a puke like you what to do. And so he told me a bunch of things to do in order to stay sober one day at a time for the rest of my life. He said something very important to me. He said, if you do exactly as I tell you to do, when I tell you to do it, you will never have to drink again. It was the first time I ever heard it that way. I had heard, don't you ever drink again, and you better not drink again, and if you drink again, you're fired, and if you drink again, you know, we're going to violate you and all that kind of stuff, but I had never heard you don't have to drink again. And what it told me was that he understood. I was one of those guys, by the time I got to AA, I was having toxic reactions to booze. In other words, I couldn't keep it down. And, you know, I'd try to take a big slug from a bottle, and it just wouldn't make it down my throat. You know, everything, you know, I mean, that's alcoholic. I'm not saying you have to be that way to get here, but that's you're drunk. If you're kicking back booze and you still want to drink it anyway, I mean, that you're a drunk. You know, I mean, there's, and so I just followed this guy around, and I don't know if I was willing to go to any length, but I did everything I was told. And he had this way of making me believe that every direction, and he was one of these guys who took over my life. I had a lot of, what does that have to do with sobriety and all this kind of stuff? And, you know, I only said stuff like that once because I got slammed so hard that I just never raised an objection again. I remember he took me down to his home group where he had come from in DeKalb, Illinois. Basically, you drive from Milwaukee, you drive through corn for like 2.5 hours, and then you end up in there's Northern Illinois University, a Walmart, and a little town. And in the back of this pawn shop, they had a meeting at 10 o'clock on Saturday nights. I love going to Enthusiastic AA. The YPG is an enthusiastic group. Monday Night Speakers is an enthusiastic group. I mean, you know, I hear big circuit speakers like Clancy talk about the value of enthusiasm in AA. That's not how I would describe this group. They were not enthusiastic. They were serious. And so you walk through all this junk, basically. It was called the Bargain Addict. A couple drunks, Jimmy D and another guy, ran it down there, and they had this 10 o'clock meeting. You go past all these, like, big CRT computer monitors and wiffle ball bats and, you know, a bunch of weapons and all this kind of stuff, which made me feel comfortable thinking that they're drunks in proximity of, you know, guns and stuff like that. And I walked in there. Hey, guys, how you doing? And they're all sucking down cigarettes, and what the hell are you supposed to be? And I was like, well, I'm an alcoholic. Well, sit down. Be quiet. You know, I mean, and that's kind of how they were. But the topics of the meetings were ones that I could relate to, and they talked about alcoholism, and they talked about resentments, and they talked about being spiritually sick, and they talked about submitting to God and being separated from God and all the things that I couldn't really put my finger on or put words to, but I knew were going on with me, you know. They took AA very seriously, and they took they expected a very strong commitment. My sponsor expected a strong commitment. And, I mean, you know, I did a lot of things I did because I knew if I would, my sponsor would fire my ass. And, you know, and he also had me believing that, you know, it's the one thing that I don't want to do that's going to get me drunk. It's the one thing I refuse to do or the one thing I insist on continuing to do that will always get me drunk. And so anyway, how long do I do this? All right. So anyway, I got into doing this stuff with these guys. And I'll tell you, it was very serious. And then after the meeting, they developed an ethic in me, which is very important, and that I try to uphold to this day. And that is sharing the sober experience one-on-one with another alcoholic. That really what AA is to each and every alcoholic is a series, like a guy used to say, an endless series of one-on-one relationships and meetings and fellowship and all that stuff is very, very nice. But really where AA lives and breathes is when one alcoholic talks to another. So we're going to start you doing that. And so they would have the guys start talking to me because I was the fresh meat. And they would bring me in there. And there's a guy named Paul the Wall who was like 6'8" and weighed like, I mean, he wasn't fat or obese, really, but he must have been 500 pounds. I mean, you get in there, and I mean, like he would eclipse the sun. And he would kind of work you into a corner and say, so what are you doing to treat your alcoholism? And I didn't know how to answer questions like that, but that's how I learned. Well, you know, I'm going to meetings. Oh, is that it? You know, and then they would talk. And then I was one of these guys. I was arrogant and ignorant when I came into AA. And that was, again, because I was angry and all that kind of stuff. And you know, people would, I did, there is no better way to establish that you're a dumbass in AA other than to claim intelligence in defiance of direction or truth. You know what I'm saying? Well, you don't understand. See, I'm pretty smart, and I'm college educated and all this kind of stuff. I'll never forget, and I never said this again. I said that to one guy who I thought was stupid, you know, and so I figured he'd be intimidated by that information. He'd get off my case. And we were at a restaurant after the meeting, and he looked over to a bunch of other guys sitting at the main table. He's talking to me alone. He said, we got a smart guy over here. And like three of them get up, sit down at the table, and about an hour later, I'm not feeling so smart. You know? And I'll tell you, that seemed brutal and harsh and mean and insensitive. And I remember hearing, because I didn't know how to process at the time, I remember hearing, you know, well, we're all about tolerance and kindness and love and patience and understanding. And what I thought that meant is when I ran my mouth off, you would say, unlike all those cruel people out there, that, oh, you're absolutely right. You're right to feel that way. That I thought that that's what they talked about, you know, when they talked about love and tolerance. What they were talking about with love and tolerance is we love you, and this is true of all of us, we love you despite what you've done and despite what you're thinking is wrong and all that kind of stuff. That we take you as you are and we show you what we've been shown. And as a result, you don't have to do the things you did anymore. You don't have to drink the way you do. The love and understanding is of the person, not of the bullcrap coming out of their mouth. And so anyway, and I didn't appreciate it at the time. And I looked back on that, and it was... it absolutely positively saved my life. You know, I did not come in here a portrait of willingness, but they were willing to coach me the rest of the way, and they did so by demonstrating that the way I was living was wrong. You know, I mean, I think sometimes people come into AA thinking that AA is a support group for your way, and that's not what happens here. AA is a way. It is a plan. You don't have to have one. As a matter of fact, your plan blows. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure I've heard it before, and you know, it sucks. And if that sounds judgmental, I feel terrible about that. But I had a plan. And so before I even got into steps or anything else, I was broken down. And I was made to be just another drunk in Alcoholics Anonymous, doing the same things that everybody else is doing, not creating exceptions for myself based on what I thought was different. And that was extraordinarily important. Okay, I've got 5 minutes. So, you know, I was looking at this show on the History Channel, and or one of those channels, and it's called The Crumbling of America, and it's about the infrastructure problem and all this kind of stuff. And the show opens up, and there's like traffic cam footage of a bridge or something. It's just in there. It's a bridge. It looks just fine. And all of a sudden, you're looking at it, and you're like, what the hell are they doing with this? And then right when you ask that, the whole bridge collapses. Just like that, you know. And when you saw it, I mean, it was a pretty good shot of the bridge. And when you saw the bridge, there didn't look to be anything wrong with it at all. I mean, it looked just fine. I mean, and cars were driving over it, you know, right before it. Hey, honey. Right before it happened. And, you know, and it looked just fine. And the car that went over it, it passed just fine, you know. And I was thinking, you know, and then they went on to describe how cracks start in the foundation and what all the problems are. And that they often describe that there, you know, on the surface, there's a lot of stuff done to the surface, but what really matters is the stuff that's been ignored for all these years. And it never starts out like a big problem, you know. It starts out like a little crack in the foundation, a nut coming loose in the trusses, whatever it may be. And it got ignored. And over time, and you know, as time went by, people said, oh, it's not that bad, we'll deal with it later. Oh, it's not that bad, we'll deal with it later. It's not that bad, we'll deal with it later. Until eventually, you know, and I'll tell you, I endeavored to make myself look better than I felt all the time. I figured I had to. Now, that didn't make me any better. That didn't make me any stronger. It didn't make me of any more value to anybody around me or anything like that. But I thought it did. It was really all that I was prepared to do before I got here. People say, why do you need God? And the answer is I couldn't face the truth without God. You know, like it or not, AA has one express purpose, and that's to draw you closer to God. You know, and what God can do for you and do for all of us is give us the power, the strength, and the courage to face the things that we've never wanted to look at. I think the number one fear of any alcoholic, and I know this through my own experience, through sponsoring others and all that kind of stuff, is to face the truth. There's some one thing we don't want to look at, one thing we don't want to deal with. That's the crack in the bridge. And at first, it doesn't seem like it's that big a deal. Screw it, I don't have to deal with this. This is not going to get me. And then problem is we ignore that crack, but then we apply the same ethic or the same faulty method to another problem and another problem. And for me, drinking was the way I dealt with it a long time, but that didn't mean just because I did a trip stumble and a face plant in my first AA meeting didn't mean that stopped. I had to face the truth. I had to see what it was about me. And then I had to make, you know, the firm you know, I had to come to a humbling realization that there really wasn't much I could do about it, that I would have to see God, and that only God could do this for me, that only God could really fix the cracks. But before that happens, I have to say, you know what, here are the cracks. You know, I don't know when an alcoholic is going to go out. I've heard somebody say, well, everybody has a grace period, you just don't know how long it is. But I'll tell you, in my experience, it is always the one thing that you think doesn't matter. The one thing that you don't want to look at, the one thing that you insist on doing or refuse to stop doing or whatever it may be, that's what'll get you. And I can't tell you when, but it will. And I found myself into sobriety, not being able to live with certain things. But the reason I'm still here is because I went through what I thought was humiliation and embarrassment, talking to my sponsor, talking to my my family, whoever I needed to talk to about it, and then seeking God about it. And that is how AA works, you know. And I'll tell you, the two fundamental facts of my life are two things I didn't believe when I got in here. And they are that there is a God and he will do for me what I cannot do for myself. And that AA works. Happy New Year. Thanks.
Stephen Alcoholic. Hey, Stephen. This is Dr. Bob's last message delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing that I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill, and a thrill when I think that we all had the same problems. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you'll pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I've been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like. So my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are two or three things that flash into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard the erring member, the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get to the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help that has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.